You're listening to a recording made back in 1910 by self-styled anthropologist, photographer, and visionary Edward Curtis. It's an ancient song from one of the native tribes in Western Canada, part of a gigantic archive of recordings, writings, and most importantly, photographs of native peoples of North America. Curtis's photos are some of the most famous images ever made, and you would recognize them even if you don't know who Curtis is. Timothy Egan tells the story of Edward Curtis's life and goals in his latest book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Egan says Curtis understood the power of the new medium of photography from the moment he began taking family portraits.
Curtis would take a portrait and people would say, "My God, you get me. You somehow get me." Teddy Roosevelt said the picture that Curtis took of him in his home in Sagamore Hill was the best picture anyone had ever taken of a man who was the most popular American in the world. Roosevelt used it in his biography. Curtis had a way of finding the humanity in people. And remember, he did all this with glass plate negatives. You know, when he started out, he was schlepping these negatives to the Grand Canyon, to Mount Rainier, to these high mesas in New Mexico and these prairie spaces in the Dakotas. But it was a popular, booming medium. People were starting to recognize the artistry of it. And this guy with the sixth grade education, Curtis, was at the forefront of it.
What did Edward Curtis's reputation for being able to bring out the character of individuals, of getting his subjects, how did that work with Native Americans who didn't particularly want to be gotten by anyone, let alone an American photographer?
Yeah, John, that's exactly right. I mean, at the time Curtis starts, this is the start of the 20th century. Let's just put this in context. America is a nation of 76 million people, but how many Indians are there? There are less than 250,000, down from perhaps 20 million at European contact. So the conventional wisdom is they're going to disappear. And Curtis sees these sort of almost spectral figures, and as he said, he wanted to make them live forever. But it started out as a very difficult project. They threw dirt at his camera. They would charge him with their horses. They complained, but he was persistent. After a while, his reputation was such among the tribes that they would seek him out. They wanted him to come. Now, if I could give you just one example.
Please.
Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce was perhaps one of the two best-known Native Americans at the start of the 20th century, the other being Geronimo. But he's living as a prisoner of war, as was Geronimo. He couldn't leave the reservation without permission from the executive, from the White House itself. They bring him to Seattle for a University of Washington Husky football game when they sort of parade him around as this curiosity. And only Curtis seems to understand what Joseph really wants, which is his land back. And Curtis talks him into posing for him. And I can't look at that picture of Chief Joseph. It was taken in 1903, a year before he died, without being almost moved to tears. The eyes are so penetrating. The face is just so telling and so searing. He never faked it. He spent a long time with these people so he could try to catch that combination of both defeat and defiance.
And where most Americans would see in the face of Chief Joseph this kind of Buffalo Bill sort of Wild West show kind of face, he saw the vast tragedy of what had happened to all of his people.
That's correct. And you know why? Because he bothered to get their story down. This is one of the unknown things about what Curtis did. It's considered now the largest single anthropological expedition enterprise ever undertaken by a single man, not undertaken by a single American, by a single human being. He started out in 1896 and he ultimately ended up recording more than 10,000 songs on this primitive wax cylinder. He ended up writing down vocabularies and pronunciation guides for 75 languages, many of which would be lost to us now. That's why the portraits pay off. So because he bothered to get the story behind the people, the pictures had such authenticity.
Writer and journalist Timothy Egan. This is The Takeaway. We're talking with Timothy Egan, author of the new book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Egan says the entire Curtis archive of Indian photos and recordings wouldn't exist if Curtis hadn't stood up to the richest and most formidable man in the world, J.P. Morgan, back in 1906.
Morgan is the Federal Reserve. We didn't have a Federal Reserve until 1913, so he's the richest banker. He's the guy everyone goes to during the crashes. He's also a great collector of Renaissance art, of high old masterpieces, of you know, marbled things from here and there. He's bringing to New York these vast collections, and Curtis is down to basically his last chance because he's decided to do this huge undertaking. You know, in some cases, there are 20, 30 people on Curtis's payroll. He needs translators. He needs people to go out and find the people and talk to them. He needs anthropologists. He has to pay an editor. He has to pay a writer. He has to pay all the transportation costs. He's funding this himself out of his money from his photography business. And so he's always broke. So he goes into Morgan's lair, and Morgan gives him just a few minutes, and after a while says, "Mr. Curtis, I have no time. I'm not interested in this project." But Curtis opens his portfolio and shows him one more picture. And it's a woman named Mosa, a 12-year-old Mojave native. And Morgan looks at this picture, and it just captivates him. And after looking at Mosa, this 12-year-old Mojave girl, Morgan does decide to fund the Curtis expedition, does decide to give him money, although it's sort of a pact with the devil because it will pay for all the staff stuff. It won't pay Curtis. Curtis will work for free.
So in the end, the value, the net worth of Edward Curtis couldn't be worse as you tell the story. And the value of these complete sets of Edward Curtis photographs couldn't be greater. Perhaps the greatest irony of all.
That's very well put. And that is, isn't that the typical story of the artist, not just in America, but everywhere? I mean, F. Scott Fitzgerald died thinking he was a total failure. The Great Gatsby had only sold 20,000 copies. Curtis dies utterly broke, having lost the copyright to his masterpiece, The North American Indian. Remember, there are only 272 complete sets of these 20-volume The North American Indian, this lustrous thing that he produced. Curtis himself has lost the copyright to Morgan. Morgan, it then later became public domain. Morgan sold it down the road. Morgan's estate did. So Curtis dies alone, broke, in a Beverly Hills apartment, feeling like he's a total failure. Now, just in the last year, John, in the last year, a single set of the Curtis North American Indian set an all-time record. It sold at auction for $2.4 million. And a week ago, a somewhat lesser set, it wasn't as lustrous, set an all-time Swan's auction record of $1.4 million. Curtis never saw any of that. It's most of it's public domain, of course. But what I'm trying to do with this book is restore the story of a masterpiece. I mean, I was blown away by what Curtis accomplished, this largely uneducated person devoting 40 years of his life to something so lasting, so American. And I beg any reader or listener to look at some of those pictures and not be moved. As, by the way, have many natives. The native people themselves are what started the revival of Curtis while some of the academics were putting him down.
And, of course, the happy ending on some level is that the Native Americans he documented didn't disappear.
That's the thing that Edward Curtis would be most surprised at, that the conventional wisdom was that they were disappearing. And Curtis himself wrote quite a bit about how he'd visited one tribe and they were down to 800 people. Then 5 years later, they were down to 200 people. And he could see the subject. He would go back time and again to these different tribes and he would see that they'd lost a third or half of their population. He would be most surprised, pleasantly so, by the revival that there are now more than 2 million Native Americans, that is people who have a majority blood of Native American. Many of the tribes have rebounded and revived. Some have not. Indian country is still, of course, some of the poorest areas in the United States, but many of them have revived. And when they go to revive their languages, they go to these Curtis recordings. And when they go to revive images of who they were, they proudly display pictures that Curtis took of their grandparents and their great-grandparents.
Timothy Egan, author of Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Timothy Egan, thanks so much.
John, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.